Hello and welcome to NAIS Member Voices. I'm Scott Donaldson, NAIS Member Engagement Coordinator, and today I'll be speaking with Doug Worthen, Director of Mindfulness at Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts. Doug, welcome to Member Voices.
Well, Scott, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Thanks for joining me. So I'm curious, just to start off right off the bat, could you tell us what is mindfulness?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different definitions out there. I would say two main pieces involve stabilizing attention, and the other piece is really our relationship to what's present in our experience. Typically, the relationship's described as having an accepting, kind of welcoming relationship to whatever thoughts, emotions, feelings are coming up.
And what is your role like as the director of mindfulness? What does that look like? Do you have a normal daily routine or does it vary?
Yeah, my daily routine is, you know, basically throughout the day, the class day, just meeting with different groups. And, you know, in the afternoons, I coach, I'm the head coach of the lacrosse team and work with some athletes and some of the sports teams here. And then at night, doing kind of programs, some of the parent programs around mindfulness.
How long have you been in your current role?
I started in 2010, and the role started really as a class on a Sunday with 12 students, and then just kind of grew from there every semester. It went from 12 students, went to 14, and I went to 20 on a Friday evening. I went to 40. You know, then I took some time off to do some more practice, and came back, and then we infused it into the school day. You know, we had almost a quarter of the school in mindfulness classes on a voluntary basis. And so at that point, it became, at least the level one course became required. And I think, you know, the pillars of the program, one is that it's invitational. We require it, the students to at least sit through a semester of mindfulness, but it's always an invitation to practice, and it's healthy skepticism is very much encouraged. So they're all encouraged not to believe really anything the teacher is saying, but to only believe things that are true in their experience. And I think those are important as more and more schools, you know, take this on. I think those pieces feel very important to me around having it be invitational and a healthy skepticism.
And why do you think this sort of class or this teaching is important to students?
Well, I think attention seems to be a pretty important piece, regardless of what we're doing. And so I think they find value in just understanding that part of their mind, and that a wandering attention isn't kind of it's not abnormal. But there are ways to stabilize it, which is, I think, they find helpful. And I think really no one, you know, we weren't really taught this kind of how to relate to emotions and feelings or many of us aren't. And so I think they're really helpful. It's helpful to many to, I'm actually supposed to feel this emotion, seeing it as it comes and goes, or the thought, I can be aware of a thought, and maybe I don't have to identify or with as many thoughts or believe my thoughts. So I just think it's a helpful, it's a support in helping them navigate their own mind and experience, and especially the adolescent experience, which I think a lot of them are feeling intense emotions, the most intense emotions they've ever felt, and having new thoughts. And so really it can be a challenging time, and to have some supports there can be really helpful.
Is there any sort of exercise or anything that you can take us through now, just sort of as an example of what you advise or what might happen in your class?
Yeah, you know, quick little exercise is, if someone's listening to this, would be to, you know, they can close their eyes if they want, and just to receive the sounds that are coming out of the whether your phone or your radio, and the difference between the kind of texture and vibration of my voice or the sounds that are in the room versus the story in the mind about them. So you might be imagining me or some of the sounds around you in the mind. And I think little practices like that help us to see what's actually the true experience of hearing versus the kind of story the labels were putting on them, is just like a very simple but powerful piece. Because in the same way, where when we see people, right, with sight, it's like, are we seeing them, or are we seeing the kind of label, the judgments, or the story about them? And I think it's the same with emotions. It's, you know, are we kind of building a story about an emotion, or are we actually feeling the true experience of sadness, boredom, joy? You know, so I think teasing these pieces apart is can be fun to do in a lot of different realms of the mind.
And have you noticed a change in students or their approach to your class since you started 8 years ago to now?
I think it's really interesting, the waves of kind of interest in a way. You know, I think, which has kind of been sensed in the culture overall, is like, you know, some days you'll hear everything about mindfulness, and, you know, some days there's, you know, it's kind of died down, the kind of, at least the media kind of hype. And I think that's been interesting here, being over 8 years. It's, you know, some years there's a little bit more kind of buzz about it, and then some years it dies down a little bit and then it increases again. You know, I think that piece has been fun to watch, but underneath that is like this really core kind of growing, committed group of practitioners here amongst the faculty, the staff, amongst the parents, amongst, and then the students. You know, I guess students are here from grades 9 to 12, but it feels more like it's just normal now. So it's not anything, it's not that kind of weird out there class. It's more, it's just kind of part of the fabric of the community.
Was there a phase, if you don't mind me asking, where there was any skepticism or pushback or anything like that regarding just the practice and the teaching being so maybe different and so new?
Surprisingly, there hasn't been really any. I think it helped that our school, so John Kabat-Zinn, his kids went here. He went to Middlesex, and you know, he was the kind of the person who brought mindfulness into the secular realm. And so I think there is a little bit of a kind of a special comfort with mindfulness here. And, you know, people understand the science of it, and that it's, you know, we've done research on the kids the last three years. We've asked them, has this influenced or been in any way like contradicting or challenging their own religion? And again, not one student has said it has. So it's It feels like it's been very well received.
I'm curious too about, you said that you teach adults as well, is that right?
In the beginning of a semester, I'll send out an email to, you know, the faculty and staff, and they'll send me the ones who want to practice, they'll send me their free blocks, and if they want to take mindfulness 1, 2, or 3. And so again, mindfulness 1 is an introduction, 2 is kind of continuing their practice, and 3 is they're learning to guide and facilitate. And that's usually after they've done some retreat and a bunch of kind of level 2s. And the point of that one is really to, the 3 is, you know, is to encourage, you know, the faculty and staff who've been practicing a while and kind of teaching mindfully to kind of even start to guide their classes if they want, or in their athletic team if they coach, kind of bring the practice more to other areas. So in a way, I'm not kind of the one person holding the program. It's starting to be held by a lot of different people here.
And are there any other differences with how you approach teaching or working with students versus adults?
Yeah, it's been surprisingly similar, even with the faculty, staff, and parents. I guess that was one of the big surprises, I think, is how similar the kind of questions are and what people notice in their mind and what maybe challenges come up. And yeah, it's kind of like the human condition is pretty similar among the ages.
Is there a daily routine then for you prior to teaching, or at the end of your day? Is there something you do right when you get to campus and then right when you're about to leave?
Yeah, so I live actually on campus in a dorm with my wife and 30 adolescent boys. So yeah, I'm kind of on campus all the time. And again, the school is, you know, it's 400 students, about 70% boarding. I basically have a 3-minute walk as my commute. And yeah, I mean, besides just practicing to start the day, and then depending on what the evening is like, if I have dorm duty or not. That would be, it'll definitely vary on what before bed.
And do you like that environment and that atmosphere of living on campus?
Yeah, I love it. I think some people say I'm living their nightmare, living with teenage boys, but I feel like I'm kind of one at heart. So I love it. I love their energy. I think it's such a fascinating period in life. They're trying to, you know, as we all are, trying to figure out what's important, their values, who they are. And, you know, so many of the valuable conversations happen, you know, on dorm duty at night, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, just sitting around watching TV, you know. So I find it such a valuable time and invaluable to be around them. You know, I think seeing them in the, you know, during the day, seeing them on the sports field, seeing them at night, there's just a way in which you can, I don't know, connect on a lot of different levels.
I'm not sure if I ask this. How did you end up at Middlesex School to begin with? How did they find you, or did you find them, or how did that start?
Yeah, so I was actually a graduate. So I graduated Middlesex in 1996. And, you know, really how I went to the University of Virginia, and that's actually where I got into mindfulness. I was having some struggles with in athletics there, playing lacrosse, and just like one of the things I kept noticing was in games, I would get tense and my attention would wander and go up into worry thoughts about like, what's my coach going to think, or my parents going to think if I mess up, and that just kept happening. And so I wanted to kind of understand that, and someone gave me a mindfulness book, and I was like, why has no one introduced this to me? It makes so much sense, and is really, you know, dissecting the trap of that tension that was happening in the game and that distraction that was happening in the game. And so at that point, it was like, okay, well, this needs to come into education. It took, you know, a few years later, and I was in the business world for a while, then a few years later, I got stage 4 lymphoma. And, you know, seeing the practice, how helpful it was going through, you know, the ups and downs of cancer, being told you're going to, you know, you're not going to make it, you're going to be doing great, you know, ups and downs, and people telling you different things, and seeing it was like my lifeline through all of that, and came out of that very clear that, like, a lot of courage and clarity that this needed to be kind of offered, and at least youth needs to be exposed to it. And again, it's their choice whether to dive in, but it was felt like almost like a crime that they weren't being exposed to it. So that was basically how it started. I was very kind of doing trainings and a lot of like mindfulness retreats. And then Middlesex, the assistant head at this time, Dan Scheibe, who's actually the headmaster of Lawrence Academy now, he called. He wanted to bring mindfulness, some mindfulness speakers to the community. And he asked a friend of mine, Jeff Cohane, and I to give a speech or give a talk on assembly on mindfulness. And so we did that, and that kind of started. So just kind of helped me to work out. I mean, I was going to go really anywhere to share it, to kind of get it going and share it with youth, but it just happened to work out at Middlesex.
That's great. That's a great story. And are you cancer-free now?
I am. I got a bone marrow transplant, and so I have a new immune system. I have someone else's immune system now that's protecting me.
Wow. Awesome. That's great news. Are there other mindfulness practices and teachings at other schools that you're aware of, or is your instance at Middlesex pretty unique?
Yeah, so I guess part of my passion or my hope or my vision is to have this position basically be common in every school. Mm-hmm. Just seeing the impact and importance of it. But, you know, so many schools are bringing mindfulness programs in, but it's, I would say they're kind of to different degrees. You know, there's no right or wrong, but I feel like, you know, some people just bring an outside organization in, and there's obviously pluses and minuses to that. And some people have like one of their English teachers teaching on the side, and obviously there's limitations to that given time and practice. So I'm biased in thinking this model is very much impactful, or I would say it makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons.
Do you have a proudest moment, either with a student or something in your career that just really sticks out?
So last fall, my wife and I went up to Bowdoin College up in Maine, and two of my former students are up there doing a lot of mindfulness work, you know, And, you know, I think just seeing that, like seeing the committed practitioners, these two guys who were, you know, just incredibly committed to the practice here and continued to do retreats, and then seeing them start to bring it to that school and bring it to other people. I think there's nothing that makes me kind of brings more joy is seeing that. So I think that might be, you know, seeing former students start to share it with others, I think is one of my biggest joys.
And did you have any mentors in this field or just in your career that you've learned things from over time?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had so many mentors in the mindfulness field. I think my greatest mentor was actually my lacrosse coach, but he wasn't into mindfulness, but he showed me what how to be an unconditionally loving, compassionate presence, and to was such a great model for how to be a mentor and a leader. So his name was Ned Herder, and he just retired, but he was a great mentor of mine.
It does seem like, based on what you're saying, that there's some correlation with sports and mindfulness, especially in your life. So do you teach mindfulness to your players then as well? And have you seen that, I guess, pay off with their performance on the field?
For sure. I think the one thing we offer is one of the level twos, level two classes for students it's called Mindfulness 2B, which is mindfulness in sports. So we get a population of athletes who, find it very helpful in their athletics. As a coach in practice, we get together, we do about a minute of just sensing our body, kind of arriving in that moment and setting our intention for practice, you know, what we want to work on. And I think this conversation about being intentional with our time together, and then our time together is limited. So not to skim over those moments. You know, we have great conversations throughout this. We had a game the other day where there was a lot of pressure and we talked about it afterwards, and guys would talk about how in the pressure moments, occasionally their attention would go from focusing on the game to focusing on like the story in the mind of like what the outcome is going to be. And it was so helpful to have that conversation, because it's like, okay, well, when that happens, right, that's just a story. We don't know how the game is going to unfold. So we bring our attention back to the play, and we just like commit to the moments of the game and trust the unfolding. But the best way to have the outcome that we hope for is actually just to stay with what's happening, let go of those, you know, what the imagined outcome is going to be. And bring the attention back to the game. And I think it's very simple, but I don't think that's taught very often in athletics, and how to be, because ultimately that's the essence of, you know, poise and, you know, performance under pressure, is just having a very stable attention and not kind of chasing those thoughts about what's going to happen or particular types of thoughts.
So it does seem like you're a leader in the classroom, and then you're a leader to your players on the field. And I'm wondering sort of where that comes from. Obviously your practice, but are there other life lessons that you've learned along the way or lessons in leadership that you've picked up on over time that have stuck with you and helped to put you where you are today?
Yeah, I guess to me, there's nothing more exciting than having one of my blind spots pointed out to me. I find that, and I think a piece to that is this part of feedback, of being kind of comfortable with who you are, knowing your goodness, and then being willing to hear and encouraging feedback from kind of all those around you. I think that's the thing, is with blind spots, we need the help of others to see them. You know, the way I lead is really one of wanting to hear the voices, wanting to communicate, and wanting people to feel comfortable sharing their view. And ultimately, we're all better. The whole team's better. The class is better. When everyone is able to share their view, and the collective view is so much better than just one view.
If you could describe your, I guess, communication style, what would that be, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, my communication style, I've found nonviolent communication super helpful. So I think that kind of goes with the sense of, you know, we should really honor what we're feeling and our view, and wanting to hear other people's kind of what they're feeling, their view. And then those are ultimately pointing towards, you know, needs and values. And then we can work, like then we can work together to meet those needs, values, and come up with strategies to do that. But we first need to kind of get clear with the views that are in the room or on a team, and the feelings and values that are behind those.
Is there some place that you turn to for inspiration in your work?
Yeah, I just long retreats. I find if anyone, I guess, out there listening is wondering what to do, to, you know, first to really learn what mindfulness is and to learn how to be, you know, to teach mindfully or to be a mindfulness teacher and share it with others. I think that kind of longer retreats of like 7 to 10 days or month long retreats or even more are just invaluable. And I guess that's one of my, you know, worries in the, as mindfulness becomes kind of popularized, that people, that doesn't become, or that loses kind of the importance. And it is so important. It's been so important for my journey. And I just hope that, you know, I think I almost didn't even know what mindfulness was until I did a long retreat.
And are there things that you either read or watch or listen to that help as well?
Yeah, I guess my journey has been, you know, reading about it and taking teacher trainings. But ultimately, like if we haven't seen it in our own experience, not to try to teach it. And I can sense it as a teacher. It's so funny. Sometimes I'll say something and it's like, well, was that because I read it in a book, or was that because I actually saw that in my own mind? And I would encourage those teaching it to, if you haven't seen it in your experience, in your practice, then don't teach it. And I actually, I'm saying that from experience, because I remember my second year teaching here, I was like, wait a second, I think I just said like the last couple of things from like a Jon Kabat-Zinn book instead of my practice. And so then ultimately took time off to practice more and make sure I was speaking more out of my experience versus what I was reading.
And you mentioned going on a retreat to get away, and that sort of being the ideal path if someone wants to become more mindful just on a daily basis and before they start their day at work or at home or what have you. I hesitate to, maybe tips isn't the right word, but is there advice or are there things that you would advise that people try to do or start with?
Yeah, and I guess just first to clarify, when I say retreat, for people who don't really know what that is, basically, I mean, it's almost like a mindfulness boot camp in a way. So it's just a lot of intensive practice. So I feel like that's, again, when I talk about retreat, that's what I mean. But of course, ways to start, I think, you know, there's the apps, Headspace, 10% Happier, those are great apps to start with. Finding a group nearby is super helpful. You know, I think that's one of the cores to my role here is just creating groups. And there's so much support that comes from, you know, this group that meets together, you know, every week and the faculty get to know each other, the students get to know each other and then know each other's practice and kind of support each other in the journey over the semester.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that's really cool. And I like to sort of close out these conversations just to get to know you a little bit better. And so I'm curious if you're willing to share, is there something about you that few people know or that would surprise people? And you can decline too.
Good question. Few people know or would surprise people. I think some of my most profound meditations have been underwater as a scuba diving instructor. I might surprise people.
Oh. You were the instructor?
Yeah. So actually right after school, I lived on my buddy and I bought this really like old sailboat, and we didn't really know how to sail, but we knew that living on a boat, like it was 30 feet long, and we knew we didn't have to pay rent because you could just anchor it anywhere. So we did that. And I just was kind of almost a spiritual quest in a way. I was just reading a bunch of mindfulness books. And, but in that process, you know, ended up in St. John and ended up getting my dive master's and really fell in love with scuba diving and then moved to Hawaii and lived on a live aboard scuba diving boat. And we dive 4 times a day. And I think diving so much, it was just some kind of incredible meditative experiences, just with the sound of the breath, kind of in silence in a way with the, you know, with the creatures underwater. You know, I would almost just sit by a coral head for a long time, just seeing this universe of activity in this one little part of the ocean. And that, you know, was some of my, I don't think I would have called it meditation at the time, but I couldn't have been more kind of focused and, you know, I think absorbed in the activity.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, I could see where that would be very centering and calming. And my last question is, if you had one more hour in your day, what would you do with it?
That's an easy one. I would just be meditating more.
Right. I thought you might say that. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of NEIS Member Voices, and thanks again to Doug for taking the time to speak with me today. We've included some great resources on some of the areas that we've discussed at neis.org/membervoices. So keep an eye on that page for resources as well as new podcast episodes. And don't forget, we always want to hear from you. Please feel free to share your stories, questions, and comments, and people that you think should be featured on the podcast with us at membership@neis.org.